we will call the meeting of the Planning Commission for July 25th, 2018. Could we have a roll call and determination of quorum?
Chairperson Sattler. Vice Chair Borders.
Present.
Commissioner Eswine.
Here.
Commissioner Monray.
Here.
Commissioner Preston.
Here.
Commissioner Stoll.
Here.
Commissioner Tingle.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Planning Commission, including any matters that may not specifically included on the agenda as an action item. Is there any public comment at this time? Seeing none, for possible action, review and approval of the minutes from June 27, 2018. Any changes or modifications or?
Mr. Chairman, I move their approval.
We have a motion to approve. Do we have a second? Second. Have a second, Commissioner Tingle. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Abstain.
Okay, thank you. Modification of agenda. Is there any, Lee, any need for a modification or anything? I think we are going to on the nomination or election thing.
Yeah, thank you. For items F, the other action items that relate to the election of the chair and vice chair, actually your bylaws say that your first action after the public hearing item should be that. So if we switch F2 and F1 and F2,
we'll
and just flop,
go
flip those.
And then we'll go back and change
the bylaw and address the bylaw, yes.
E1, AB18-094, for possible action to make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding an application from Carson City for abandonment up to 20-foot-wide public egress easement on Ash Canyon Road to Wellington South, then north on Wellington West, turning west and ending on the southwest corner of Lot 12 of Wellington Crescent Subdivision.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner Borders.
NRS 281A420 requires that I disclose a conflict of interest and abstain from voting when I have a disqualifying comment. In my private commitment, I am a homeowner of the Wellington Crescent Property Owners Association, which is a homeowners association to which the property proposed to be abandoned would be vacated. In addition, I also own a home within the Wellington Crescent subdivision. Because of my continuing relationship with the Homeowners Association, which may benefit from this abandonment, and also because I have a pecuniary interest in my real property, which is located within the subdivision governed by the Homeowners Association, I believe I have a conflict of interest and therefore will not be voting on this matter.
Sir, nothing worse than pecuniary.
No, no.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hope Sullivan, Planning Manager. The subject easement was recorded in 1992 to allow the public a means of ingress and egress to Ash Canyon. Per the terms of the easement was to be rescinded and revoked when an additional means of ingress and egress was dedicated to allow the public access to Ash Canyon. The alternative access was secured in 2003. The easement to be abandoned is superimposed on a 50-foot-wide private access easement. So the action of the abandonment before you today will not affect that existing private access easement. The Board of Supervisors has the authority to abandon the right-of-way. The Planning Commission reviews the request against the 7 required findings and makes a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. In the staff report, the staff has reviewed those 7 required findings and was able to make each of them in the affirmative and is recommending that the Planning Commission recommend approval to the Board of Supervisors. The city's real property manager, Stephanie Hicks, is present and is technically the applicant. And I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Questions for staff? Seeing none, would the applicant like to come forward? For the record, if you'd state your name for us, please.
Thank you. Good evening. For the record, Stephanie Hicks, real property manager for Carson City. I wanted to just take an opportunity to let you know we have reviewed the conditions of staff, and we accept and agree to those. The city really considers this to just be a cleanup of something that occurred in the past. You know, in 2003, the new easement was provided, and those improvements have been constructed, and so we'd just like to take care of this for the property owners. It's my understanding that the Homeowners Association has also had the opportunity to review the application and that there were no opposition to it at all.
So understanding that there still will be an easement, as you mentioned, for utilities, et cetera, to come through there, but the other will then revert back to the property owner.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for the applicant? Seeing none, thank you. Bring it back for discussion or a motion.
I move to recommend that the Board of Supervisors approve AB-18-094, an abandonment of easement application to allow an abandonment of up to a 20-foot wide public ingress egress easement from Ash Canyon Road to Wellington South, then north on Wellington West, turning west and ending at the corner southwest corner of Lot 12 of Wellington Crescent Subdivision, adjacent to assessor's parcel numbers referred to in the order of abandonment, based on the 7 findings and subject to the conditions of approval contained in the staff report.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second
from Commissioner Tingle. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Thank you.
Abstain.
Abstain. One abstention.
One
Thank
abstention.
You. E2, SUP-18-095, for possible action to consider a special use permit to exceed the number of permitted freestanding signs, to exceed the permitted height of one freestanding sign, and to increase the permitted sign area for congregate care facility on properties on multifamily apartment located at 1001 Mountain Street, APN 001-201-34.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hope Sullivan, Planning Manager. The subject 4.9-acre property is currently being improved with a congregate care facility. As you can see on the slide in front of you, as well as on the picture on the front page of your report, the property has frontage on 3 streets and will take access from each of these 3 streets. The applicant is proposing a freestanding sign at each point of access, as well as 2 internal signs, as shown on the site plan that was in your packet. Internal illumination is proposed for only 1 of the internal signs. The signs along the street frontages will utilize external illumination. Per the existing sign regulations, the applicant may only have 1 freestanding sign, and they're proposing 5. The applicant may only have 32 square feet, and when you look at the cumulative total of these signs, it exceeds 32 square feet. I should clarify on that. The applicant's allowed 1 freestanding sign not to exceed 32 square feet, 1 address sign for the entire site not exceeding 4 square feet, and an address sign not exceeding 2 square feet for each unit within the complex. The maximum height allowed is 6 feet. In terms of the signage being proposed, I have on the slide, there are 2 internal signs. One is 28 square feet, and you can see with a height of 5.5 feet, and you can see that in the context of a person, and that we don't anticipate to be visible from off-site. The second sign, internal sign, will be 12 square feet and 4 feet tall. The sign on Mountain Street is proposed to be 16 square feet and 6 feet tall. The same for the sign on Minnesota Street. And then the largest sign is on Washington Street. And I used this graphic as opposed to a graphic similar to the others because this shows the slope differential. And this is the sign that's exceeding the 6 feet in height. It's 7 feet 4 inches. And that's because it needs to be behind that power pole. And although it's somewhat subtle, the site does slope upwards so that you end up with a taller sign. But I think in context, it will be fine. Development standards 4.6.5 allow for variations to the standards by special use permit. As you know, the Planning Commission is authorized to issue a special use permit upon making each of the 7 required findings in the affirmative. Staff has reviewed those 7 required findings in the staff report, and we are able to make those in the affirmative. April Wojcik, representing the applicant, is present, and I'm happy to go further in depth or answer any questions.
Just for clarification, that is the Washington Street sign, and it's got the 1001. I guess that's just from the picture, because I believe in here it says that there can be no number. It's got to be Mountain Street on that sign.
The address of the subject property is 1001 Mountain Street, and so to avoid confusion, the fire department is requesting that the addressing on all signage, to the extent addressing is put on the signage, read 1001 Mountain Street. Because if you're, say, on Washington Street and see 1001, you may think you're at 1001 Washington Street, and the address is 1001 Mountain Street. So it's just an issue of allowing for good response times by the emergency responders.
Then that
responders.
Would have Mountain Street added to the 1001?
If they choose to put an address on that particular sign, it would need to say 1001 Mountain Street to ensure response by emergency responders.
And the internal signs, I believe, are more for directory, because there's different types of the facility.
Right.
Kind of like the preceding buildings had a list in front of what was in the buildings.
Right. For example, this internal sign says Expressions Memory Care, whereas the other one is the care center, so in the Transitional and Rehabilitation Center. So you have different buildings with different functions, so it helps you understand which building to go to.
So it's kind of to help the visitors, not necessarily an advertising. It's helping the visitors get to the right part of the complex.
Exactly. It's more directional.
Thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead.
So when you were doing the study as far as the signage on Washington Street, I had the acquaintance or the opportunity, if you will, to take a friend to the Optum physical therapy in that building, and getting in and out of that parking lot is a bit interesting anyway. So I don't know as far as blocking line of sight for east-west traffic flow. It's problematic getting in and out of that parking lot where LabCorp is and where that Optimum Health is. And I don't know if this sign might provide any kind of obstruction for traffic. So that's my only concern about the size of that sign.
Our engineering department had a similar concern. And based on that concern, we have condition of approval number 9 that says all the signs must be outside of the site distance triangle as defined on table 12.2 of the development standards. And it goes on to talk about signs A, B, and C appear to be located close to or within the site triangle. And those correspond to the main sign maps located along the entrances to Washington and Minnesota Street and Mountain Street. So at the time they obtain building permits for these signs, they'll more specifically identify the location of those and demonstrate to the satisfaction of our engineering staff. And I should be Elaine Stephen, who's right next to me, talk. Sorry. This is all, he's the brainchild. I'm just the puppet here. But so they'll ensure that the site distance is cleared for that very reason.
Part of the reason it's behind the pole, and if they have to, they can move it in a little further to make sure they can see past it coming in. Any other questions for staff?
Just one. On Washington Street, it seems like the sign standard is 6 feet. Seems like there some of the other signs on that street are either 6 feet or taller. And I don't have a problem with this sign. I just have a question about our consistency.
Yeah, I did a site visit, and when I did my site visit, my focus was more on incompatibility and looking at adjacent uses And so I was so focused on use, I think I glossed over the signs in the area, so I apologize.
Well, they're not incompatible, and the signs are not unattractive. I mean, it's fine. They're just, if we're going to get wrapped around the axle over a couple of feet, I think we need to start looking at all of them.
But if they're set back in, or if they're information closer to the building, can they not be taller than 6 feet still?
In the staff report, it talks about the signs on Minnesota and Mountain being an overall height of 6 feet, but in the graphics that were provided by the applicant, it shows that both of those signs on Minnesota and Mountain Street being a height of 5 feet. So if they are going to be 5 feet, I would prefer that that's put in the staff report. I mean, these are monument signs. I understand what's going on Washington Street, but my preference would be to keep them no more than 5 feet. But I didn't know if something's changed in terms of those graphics. Right.
The drawing that I'm looking at, for example, on sign D, it says 5 feet 6 inches, and my guess is they're taking into account any grading they may have to do. But that's, we can certainly ask the applicant for clarification, but the grading may be, because you would measure from the natural grade.
Would the applicant please come forward? Could you state your name for us?
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is April Wojcik, and I'm with Prestige Care. And I think Hope's laid it out pretty clearly that we agree with. We do have three entrances, and we would like to have all of those signed. And then we also have two separate uses of the property, one for memory care and one for our skilled nursing and physical therapy. So
before going further, you've read the conditions of approval.
I have read the staff report, and we're in agreement with staff's recommendations.
Thank you. Just wanted to get that on the record. Questions for the applicant? Commissioner?
Can you address whether, if there's not a lot of grading or difference, that the sign itself is 5 feet or 6 feet on Minnesota and Mountain Street?
The signs on Minnesota and Mountain Street are 5 feet tall. That's the height that we... Is it 5 feet six? I know we went back and forth on that a couple of times. I'm fine with 5 feet or 5 feet six, whichever one you guys.
Legally, they could go up to six. Is
right.
That
I would just, since we're being very specific on the
yes.
Washington Street, the 7 feet 4 inches, I think that we'd be yeah. specific in the staff report for those two other signs if we could.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty precarious because our actual address is on Mountain Street, and you know, all of the utilities and everything come in right there. So we've got, you know, the fire hydrant, the backflow device, the utility pole, everything is right there. So getting a monument sign or anything there that in addition, we've got our memory care garden fenced right there. So we've got the setback for that, we've got the utilities, and so getting a sign in there was pretty challenging, and so it has to exceed, you know, our required number of signs.
The building pretty much comes out to the street on Mountain Street. I mean,
it does. It,
is there any plans for any signage on the building at all, or?
No, we don't have any plans for on the actual building. So this sign will sit out in front of the memory care garden fence, and then as traffic pulls in, there'll be a sign that says the expressions memory care. And then as people curve around, then they'll come to the main entrance and they'll see the physical therapy.
Other questions for Commissioner Gresham?
Would you be opposed to having us eliminate the possibility of putting 1001 Mountain Street on your Washington Street sign? I think that would be very confusing.
I agree.
People.
I agree completely with you. I would like to not have... I would like the Mountain Street one to be the only one with any numbers or address on it.
I think that makes more sense.
I agree.
Does that change one of the conditions?
Yeah. Condition number 8.
I think they gave an either or option on condition 8.
Yeah, but I would just soon strike it.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other questions?
So, thank you. No address.
so you know what I did.
Right.
Washington and the other, Minnesota.
It doesn't address, there was no.
But we can put it in there that they would have no.
Yeah.
Bring it back for further discussion or a motion or?
I'll certainly make a motion if need be, if I can phrase it. I move to approve SUP-095, a special use permit request to exceed the number of permitted freestanding signs, to exceed the permitted height for one freestanding sign, and to increase the permitted sign area for a congregate care facility on property zoned multifamily apartment located at 1001 Mountain Street, APN 001-201-34, based on the findings and subject to the conditions of approval contained in the staff report with the changes to condition 8, which should read, sign B on Washington or sign C on Minnesota shall have no address information shown.
And I believe adding that the two other signs are 5 feet, not six.
And two other signs being 5 feet, not 5 feet, 6 inches.
Mm-hmm. I'll second.
Second from Commissioner Borders. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. E3. ZCA-18-091 for possible action to make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding an ordinance amending Title 18 zoning, Chapter 18.03 definitions of the Carson City Municipal Code to amend the definition guest building and amending Title 18 zoning Appendix A Development Standards Division 1 Land Use and Site Design Section 1.4 Guest Building Development on the Carson City Municipal Code to delete the restrict code to delete the restriction limiting occupancy of guest buildings to family members and non-paying guests and providing other matters property related thereto. This is a continuation from our last meeting that a couple of our members were not here, so we wanted to make sure we further discussed it full board.
Yeah, thank you, Lee, for the record, Lee Plemmel. We did have quite a bit of discussion at the last meeting with five members, so I think it's good we have the full membership here to finish this discussion and make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. So I'll just briefly go over what I went over last time, just some of the background existing regulations and what has been changed since then based on some of the discussion we've had. So the primary issue that's being addressed is that currently we allow guest buildings, also known just generally as accessory dwelling units, and we allow them in Carson City with the restriction, they all have the restriction that the occupancy is limited to family members and non-paying guests. That's the current regulation. Furthermore, there's other regulations regarding them. There's limits in size. They're allowed in these various zoning districts. They're limited in size to 50% of the main residence. 1,000 square feet in basically the half acre zoning and larger, they're limited to 1,000 square feet in the single family 6,000 and 12,000, single family 6,000 and 12,000 are limited to 700 square feet. They require an administrative permit if they are, they require a special use permit in those smaller districts. They also may, if they're detached structures, may require a special use permit if they exceed those thresholds for accessory structures in general, which is 50%, 75%, for which they would need a administrative permit or special use permit. For each accessory dwelling unit, an additional parking space is required. and there are other setback height and design criteria that exist. That's a little bit stricter than the primary residence. So this is what we have in the ordinance currently today. So again, the proposed modification is basically to remove that restriction on the occupancy of it. But there are some other things that are being proposed in addition to some cleanups. So but more of the substantive things are some. The first part up there is the definition of a guest building. It was brought up that they may be attached. So that definition, per that comment, the definition's changed to mean that they include detached and attached structures that may or may not include cooking facilities. Not up there on the screen, but in the ordinance you have, and at the suggestion, there's a accessory dwelling unit definition now that refers to guest building, because accessory dwelling unit is a more common term that's used, but guest building is used throughout our code. So if somebody's looking for the definition, it gets referred back to that. In terms of the development standards, so some other changes. The minimum lot size. So we do not currently have a minimum lot size to permit somebody to develop an accessory dwelling unit in the code. You have to have, it's allowed in the zoning, it's allowed in single family 6,000, but if, let's say you had a non-conforming lot or another, some PUD that had a property of less than 6,000 square feet, today you could have an accessory dwelling unit. Again, to address some of the concerns that have come up, we're recommending that in no case are you allowed to have an accessory dwelling unit on a lot of less than 6,000 square feet. The maximum size. Let's see, what did I have a little bullet there? Now, what am I referring to? Sorry. Oh, I would also note in the packet, you'll notice from this time I included more information. I included more information from the American Planning Association on accessory dwellings in general. So I thought there was a lot of good information. Thanks to Candace for directing me to those links that got to that. But I hope that was helpful. And also attached, the first thing behind the ordinance is a matrix showing what some other communities do. So I hope that was also useful to show what Reno as well, and this was prepared by Reno actually, because they're looking at a similar ordinance recently, but it lists some of the other, what other communities in the West are doing. Minimum lot size, okay, so the maximum size, again, kind of this 1.4.4 maximum size is sort of related to the zoning where you're allowed to have the 1,000, the larger accessory dwelling unit, guest building on lots that are zoned for half acre or larger, that's in the existing. We don't have very much. There's a very small portion of Carson City that has a half acre zoning, by the way, but this minimum lot size adds that you have to have at least a half acre. Even if you're zoned single family, you can't have less, single family 1 acre, you can't have less than a half acre, and have the larger one. If you have less than that, you could possibly have the smaller version. So again, it's relating the size of the building directly to the actual lot size that you have. So that's the purpose of that change. Again, 1.4.10 is the portion that's being changed to remove the restriction to family members and non-paying guests, but I've added a couple things there that are both related to occupancy, and this came up at the last meeting to make it clear that they may not be rented on a transient basis of less than 28 days, so these aren't intended to be Airbnb rentals, they're not short-term, but like with any other property that anybody has, it could be rented for 30 days or longer. And then, as I mentioned, delete the non-paying guests. So those are that's the substance of it. You know, again, going back, the primary impetus of this has been housing issues, housing stock in the area. We had, of course, the summit today regarding affordable housing and workforce housing. Also, this proposed change is consistent with policy that was adopted in our master plan in 2006, but wasn't implemented in the past and hasn't been implemented yet, but it would be consistent with that. So with that, I guess let's start by taking questions. I know we'll have some more discussion after we take some questions, but I'll conclude with that and take questions at this point.
Lee, a couple of things I think we clarified before. So the FF 6,000, 12,000 will require a special use permit to do this, correct?
Yes.
And I'm looking at this, and so I'm guessing the half acre is at SF 2100 or 1 acre, 2 acre would be kind of where that all falls later in that statement. In other zoning districts, including SF 2100, SF 1 acre, and SF 2 acre, the size of the guest building is 1,000 square feet.
Yes, right. Okay.
We had discussed something about whether they were required to have a cooking facility. I didn't know where we ended up on that. I know that was discussed pretty heavily.
I think it's still confusing.
Okay. And the other thing, on the owner, one thing I picked up out of here is the owner has to be either primary or secondary. Is that part of our code as well? Or can these just be owned by anybody and they can have whoever's living there?
What's the second question?
As to whether the owner has to be either in the primary or the owner has to be on site. And I know you said these all have to go in per building code, so you know, they have to meet whatever codes are necessary, setbacks, et cetera, which would be controlled by the planning department, correct?
Okay, second question. Is that a third question?
No, I just, you had mentioned in our discussion before, to clarify for everyone, that all, no matter what happens, it has to be building codes. The city controls that the building is correct and whatever.
Okay. Regarding the owner-occupied, that's not an uncommon requirement in some locations. It's not always, but it's something that you could consider and make a recommendation to require it to be owner-occupied. That would certainly provide some additional limitations and restrictions.
I just like that aspect of it myself, because that way, at least when you're, if there's a problem or whatever, whoever owns it's going to be right there. I mean,
if they are actually right there. I mean, my next thing I was going to say is that it's hard to prove sometimes.
Whoever's on the deed, I would think, would have to be on the property.
Yeah, if unless they're, say, they're on vacation or stuff.
Oh,
it's
I'm not
just a little bit.
I'm just saying.
I'm not trying to talk you out of it. I'm telling you, it can be. It's one of those things that is hard to enforce. Okay, and required cooking facility. So I think I fall pretty strongly that we don't need to require cooking facilities, because we have detached structures that all over the place where that are shops that don't have cooking facilities. I guess we don't call them a guest building. Well, do we call them a guest building
right
in that
now,
case?
Right now the definition says may or may,
yeah,
may not. And what Commissioner Porter's question is whether or not if you can have a dwelling unit without cooking facilities.
So the question is whether or not you can have a dwelling unit without cooking facilities. But my example was, I don't want to, so there's lots of people that have art studios and detached buildings and other spaces that don't have cooking facilities, and I don't want to make somebody have cooking facilities if they have an art studio or something where they don't. They also may rent rooms to somebody today, and not every renter has. They may rent a room to somebody they share the house with and they share the cooking facilities with.
What about running water or whatever in the facility if they're going to be living?
So maybe this gets to your third point about the building code. So if somebody is occupying a structure, it has to be habitable for occupation. And if it's a detached structure that's a bedroom and that's what it's going to be used for, it has to meet all the minimum building code requirements, which don't necessarily include cooking facilities, but it would have to be heat, water, insulation. Yeah. Right.
Well, but in the ordinance that you provided us and the definition for guest building,
The guest building may provide complete independent living facilities for one or more persons, including permanent facilities for living, sleeping, eating, cooking, sanitation, and includes habitable attached or detached structures, which may or may not include cooking facilities. We're saying both things. And then in 1.4.3, we give people that already have guest buildings the ability to add a kitchen, which is fine.
Does that go to code?
Yeah, but that implies that if you're going to try and rent it out, you need to have a kitchen in it. So I just don't think we're consistent, and I don't know that we know what we're saying.
So, Mr. Chairman, just so I can chip in, so I know that this ordinance is a work in progress, and you know, once the draft is submitted to the DA's office and I'm able to get eyes on it, so long as I'm able to get the commission's intent with respect to, well, what are the conditions, what are the parameters, how do you exactly want to define what constitutes, you know, a guest building, what are the requirements that need to go in along with it, then, you know, I'll make sure to capture, you know, the intent of the committee and get that into the draft before it's submitted to the Board of Supervisors.
So we should probably go along like with owner on site, et cetera, and get a consensus from the group, and then we find out what we want to add or put onto it.
I forgot my train of thought there, but for the detached structures that may include habitable attached or detached structures and may include cooking facilities. So the one you referenced about adding kitchens, that's in there. The modification to that section is only to make it read better, but yeah, there was some acknowledgement that somebody had an existing guest building that didn't have a kitchen, they could add it.
I'm sorry. I personally believe that a guest building, if we're going to use it as an income producer, needs to have a kitchen. If I want to have a guest building to keep my mother-in-law in or my traveling companions when they come and visit, it doesn't necessarily have to have a kitchen in it. But if I want to use it as an income producer or as a rental, I think it needs to have a kitchen. And I guess that was kind of
refrigerator.
Well, so for zoning, we don't care. You may want to have one, but I don't know that we want to require one. You may want to rent it. Somebody else may want to build a guest building that they don't want to rent. So we don't want to be regulating how people use it.
My question is that you said that there has to be water available. That seems to be kind of ambiguous. Are we talking about a sink? Are we talking about a toilet? Or what are we talking about? Or a hose? That's one of the other things.
Well, the building code would specify the types of plumbing requirements.
So what's building code say now?
I don't know the building code and what it requires. But if it's habitable space that's going to be used for sleeping purposes, it has to meet the building code requirement for habitable space for sleeping purposes and turning, including ingress and egress. I'm not even sure it requires a bathroom because
I think it does.
Well, if it's a separate unit, it depends on how they want it
right,
to
attached,
what they want it to be.
Use the inside facility.
Not all art studios, detached art studios that people have bathrooms.
Well, maybe we're getting confused
yeah,
in
I
our
think,
definitions, and maybe we should call it what it really is, an accessory dwelling unit, and just, you know, we can have guest facilities or whatever, but let's talk about accessory dwelling units.
Well, and the guest facility references the accessory dwelling unit definition.
Reminds me where I was going to go to before. I think the way it's written now is because we didn't want people, or say we, but the city, whoever, when this was written, didn't want people subverting this second this guest building thing by doing detached units and not having kitchens in there. And then their plans show they don't have kitchens, and then somehow a year later they have a kitchen in them. That's really common. We've seen. So that's why the definition. So I think that's why that was written like that. That guest buildings include
with or without
kitchens, because all right, you're not going to trick us this time and not put one in and then put one in later. I get your point of it not reading right and being clear, but I think that's why it says that now.
In the parking space. Does that have to be on site, or would off-street parking be, you know, right on front street in front of their house be qualified?
The addition in front of, not on street. It has to be off-street parking, yes.
Is that one per unit or one per bedroom? I think we were discussing that. I think we left it at one per unit.
I think it says for one per bedroom in here.
So a two-bedroom.
Yeah, it's been, that's right. And if I didn't have that on existing regulations, I should have. It's one additional parking space per bedroom, not per unit.
I just have kind of a the owner on site issue. If you have the house next door to me and the house across the street from me are both rentals. So what's the difference between that rental and this accessory guest dwelling? The owner of the rental next to me and the one across from me, the owners aren't occupying that house.
Because
so
it's a straight rental. It's not they're taking their home and then putting a small existing dwelling part of their whatever.
Tomato, tomato. I mean, I just don't think that we should be looking at restricting if somebody's renting that house and then the owner of the property wants to put in another accessory dwelling.
Recorded who owns it, so.
Okay. My question on that, though, is to be changing the zoning to being multifamily if it's as rentals.
You'll notice in a lot of these, in a lot of these ordinances, they specifically put language in there that says that when you're adding the ADUs, it's not adding to density. So they very specifically made sure that an accessory dwelling unit does not count against the density for that particular zoning district. So it would not be in any sense changing the zoning from any kind of single-family zoning to multifamily. In terms of this discussion, I think, you know, that the split between what's considered a guest building versus a real bona fide accessory dwelling unit, I mean, we see this up at the lake because TRPA says, you know, you could have a guest building, but just as Lee's saying, you know, there better not be a kitchen in there. And we better not make sure you're basically using that guest structure to turn it into a full-fledged habitable dwelling, permanent, you know, dwelling. And I would think that the building code for a fully functioning dwelling would require some kind of cooking facilities. I can't imagine, but I haven't looked in the building code for years. So I don't know if it'd be easier to create, you know, either a different guest building to keep it as guest buildings, or just to go and just say, let's just create separate definition for accessory dwelling unit and just make it very clear. Keep the guest building language the way it is. I know it's a pain because of the way the code is set up and the development standards, but it might be easier in the long run just to say an ADU is a full-fledged dwelling unit that meets building code, has cooking facilities. You don't have to have a full-fledged ADU. Fine. Create a guest building. And you're not renting it out. But to me, I think if you're renting it out, I just can't imagine. And it could be a galley kitchen. It could be a small sink, like an efficiency unit with a microwave, but something. The other question I had was on the parking. I think it's nice in the back, 1.4.9, that there's some wiggle room. So A is talking about if the person wants some changes in terms of size or height or site design, they would have to come before the Planning Commission for a special use permit. So it's allowing some flexibility in terms of people wanting to maybe have some height issues or wanting a slightly larger size or my question is, two questions. One, would it make more sense to move the parking into A? Instead of saying that you need a variance for an adjustment to the parking, could we not treat that as a special use permit? Because if I have a small lot and I have space for two cars and it's just me, why would I need to have basically three parking spaces when it's just me and an accessory dwelling unit, as long as there's an off-street parking place for that one person? So I think to look at the possibility of, instead of saying a variance, because a variance is a much harder standard to prove, to say there's some hardship, but to say that it could be part of the special use permit to review at that time. The other final question is, on Schultz Ranch, we know that they are developing some of these next-generation homes where they've got basically accessory units, guest houses, that are built into the house itself. And I don't know, looking at the old plans and everything, whether those next-generation models are all going to be on lots that are 6,000 square feet or bigger. I do know, looking at some of the site plans that have been approved, the different phases of Schultz Ranch, that some of those lots are smaller than 6,000 square feet. So the question again would be, if it's part of a development, some of those lots, most of them are 6,000-7,000 larger, but there are some lots in Schultz Ranch, for example, and they're already building that model where it's part of the structure, it's a separate unit, it's one entrance, you take a right, you go into the accessory dwelling unit, which they could have for the relative, or they could rent it out if this ordinance passed. So I'm just wondering whether that something, it doesn't have to be something to, it's not a big issue, but I'm just thinking further down the road, if that's something, if we want more developers to do those kind of units, and it's part of the existing home, it's not a detached structure, whether that 6,000 feet still makes sense.
Well, if it's attached, I don't have as much of a problem with it, you know, rather than a detached unit, because it's all part of the footprint of the house. So if that were still, would you want them to come forward for a use permit if it's under 6,000 square feet, I would think. But
I have a concern or a question about, you know, the master plan calls for greater density in the downtown area, and we know that a lot of lots in the downtown are nonconforming. We're basically saying in this ordinance then that you can't increase the density in the downtown by putting an ADU on it. And I think that we should at least consider in the historic district or some parameters for what we consider where we want to have increased density, allowing ADUs on nonconforming lots and lots smaller than 6,000 square feet.
If they come to planning and to us, I don't really have a problem.
Wait, could we add lot size as a potential for a special use permit? Because right now, I don't know if that was the intention, but it says size, height. Could lot size be an option as a special use permit?
Mr. Chairman, when we started this last month, the accessory dwelling unit, which was mentioned in the master plan, was not in the ordinance. So we cobbled together a definition and said, oh, this guest building definition can also be the accessory dwelling unit. And from then, all our problems have erupted. I tend to agree with you now that I think maybe we leave the guest building the way it was and go ahead and define an ADU as part of this, and that way the ordinance and the master plan begin to dovetail with each other, and then the accessory dwelling unit can have its own definition, and then we can put the things in it that we think need to be in there instead of trying to make we're trying to make the Cinderella's foot fit in the glass slipper.
But with the reference from the guest building saying, see the ADU, is that necessary or not? And I guess then if the 16 that are out there, if they wanted to be an ADU, could come to us to upgrade and change what they have to make it compilable.
Yeah, what I'm saying is the concept that we had for a guest building is different than the concept we have for an associate dwelling unit. They're different animals. A couple of them may look alike, but they're different animals. And
so if you, I think what you're talking about is you want to split out units that have kitchens, units that don't have kitchens. Okay. I think there's a way to do that. So just quite frankly, I'm avoiding a new definition because every reference through all of Title 1804 is to a guest building. And if I think it'd be easier to still use that definition, but say a guest building with kitchen facilities, and then you have guest building without kitchen facilities that have different standards. And that's only just avoiding a very large packet of paper.
I understand that, but
little words.
The reality is turning out to be an accessory dwelling unit is now part of the norm and part of the vernacular. And somewhere along the way, we're going to have to address it and say, you know, we recognize that there's an animal called an accessory dwelling unit, and it looks like this. And before we had these other things, and they look like that. Now, if we can find a way to mesh them together, we tried here, and I don't think it's working very well. And I know you don't want to do it, but.
If we go with guest buildings and change that definition to what our definition of an ADU is, and because it says guest buildings refer to the definition of ADU, we just have to get those two definitions in line.
No, ADU says refer to guest buildings.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So we just have to make sure the definitions are the same.
Yeah, but then if I want to build my art studio, what is it?
It's not a guest building. It's an accessory. It's an accessory.
Okay.
I think as long as we get the definitions close and then keep where they have to come, if they're below 6,000, whatever, they have to come to us for, and planning and us for approval, I think we can probably accomplish it without changing all of Title 18. Commissioner Tingle.
So I think the confusion for me is you've got an accessory dwelling unit and a guest building, and to me, guest building is indicative of a place someone is going to stay, not an art gallery or an art studio. If you have, if there's a way to incorporate and not get all wrapped around the accessory dwelling unit, if we say guest dwelling unit and an accessory building, maybe that can kind of clear up anything, because the guest dwelling unit means somebody's going to live there. Right. An accessory building means, hey, I've got an art studio. Nobody's going to be living in it, but we're going to be using it for, you know, whatever purpose we're going to be using it for. So I don't know if that would clear it up a bit for me, is that being an ADU, I understand that they refer to it in other communities as such, but I don't know, maybe if they don't have the guest dwelling issue, that's just my take on it.
And again, our main challenge here is to approve, will they be able to rent them out? That's the main change we're trying to make, so.
Okay, now these are all special use permits, and they're actually conditioned on that ownership, correct?
Not all of them, unless they were a bit bigger than 75% of the house or whatever. Initially, the ones that we approved earlier, they could have been built without even coming to us, correct? If they were 1,000 square feet or less and whatever, they could have gone in.
Well, my question is a real estate agent, right? Am I selling a house with an extra cottage on the back that can be used as a rental? Now, there are, you know, hundreds of agents right now, and I'm sitting here, and I'm confused as heck, and I've been doing this for 40 years. I don't know, can I sell that without the special use permit? Can I put my kid in the back of it? If somebody lists the house and says, there's another building out there, it doesn't have a kitchen, but, you know, it'd be a great place for your kid, you know? Or it doesn't have a kitchen, oh, you could probably go ahead and rent it out as long as it's over 30 days. So that's where we're going to have to get some clarification.
may be partially my, I don't know, or we seem to be dispersing from what the object we're trying to accomplish.
Lee, how many references to guest, where are all the references to guest facilities?
Accessory dwelling, I mean, accessory structure definition, so more, that, but that's, we're already in the definition section, but it's through, it's in every district where it's permitted.
So it's through
1804.
It's just listed as a permitted use.
Yeah, right. Or accessory use or whatever, yeah. Or conditional use depending right.
but
on
it,
what.
It, but it's just listed. Zoning district. It's not like there are any additional standards for any, depending on a zoning district.
Well, there are, because they're in the development
standards. Right, but they are in the development standards. They're not
in
Title 18.
Besides this ordinance that you already have in front of you, it would be 1804, which is where all the zoning districts are listed and all the permitted uses under each zoning district.
I understand that. So you're saying that it would be, you know, it would be onerous to have to add in accessory dwelling unit or in Title 18.
All right, so we can change the name. We could do that. So
but what's the
we still need some direction on what the standards are going to be for those.
Do we have accessory building? Because that's where the art studio and that would fall is in the accessory building.
The
guest building is more in line with the AD, you know, this development unit, dwelling unit.
I fully understand the distinction you're trying to make now and the confusion between these where guests stay and don't have kitchen facilities, where they're detached and they're guests and whether or not they're attached or detached and have kitchen facilities. Okay. So.
Are you saying you'd like to take another run at it?
Not yet, because you haven't given us any direction as to what you want those standards to be once we distinguish between those things in the definitions. Like, for example, the owner-occupied, are you okay with the other standards that are proposed? I mean, if that's the last thing is definitions and everything else is good.
Well, I think, you know, we've had some discussion because I brought up the owner-occupied, and I can go along with what they're saying. I have no problem with that. That's why I'm trying to get a feel. What do we want in there as individuals? And let's talk about it a little bit and say, okay, no, that's not that important. Kitchen, I can live with or without a kitchen. I just want something that's going to be readable for people that are looking at it and workable for staff. So. That's the main thing.
I think if it works and if it's easier to have guest buildings or delete guest buildings completely, but if it's easier just to keep the guest building, because if somebody wants a unit for their relative or their son or daughter that are staying temporarily, but if it's an ADU, I would think. If it's a real dwelling, that according to building code, it's going to have some kind of a cooking facilities, even if it's only very modest cooking facilities. But I think it would be great not to have the owner occupancy. Most jurisdictions around the country have gone away from that. They're not requiring an owner occupant on the property anymore. I think that was sort of the first generation of ADU ordinances that came out. And again, the other thing is that, you know, if there is an owner on the property or if the person's renting the main house, you know, it could always be that the first person there, whether the owner or renter, wants to live in the smaller house. And, they don't have to live in the big house. But again, I think if we can just have a little more flexibility at the back there for the special use permit requirements to say if your lot is a little bit less than 6,000, you could still come forward with a special use permit and have some discussion and give some flexibility and to Paul's point about downtown, I think is a good one.
Seeing what we're trying to accomplish with that, Commissioner, I'm in agreement as far as the owner occupancy, because you may have someone wanting to invest in these and has the money to accomplish and bring 10 or 20 of them forward, which is what we're hoping to help the housing through the meeting today and stuff with. So if I make it an owner occupancy, then they wouldn't be willing to do that. So anyway, so on that, I will rescind my request.
And I'd like to agree with Candace that I think that the parking, you know, let's not be overly restrictive in parking requirements. You know, people are going to find parking spaces. And these things are probably not going to be proliferating in all of the residential subdivisions. They're going to be, you know, here and there. It's not going to be, you know, allowing people to park on the street if they've got two cars is not going to be a big problem. I mean, people do it now anyway, you know. People got their RVs parked in their parking space, and they park their car in the street.
Is there a parking requirement for the owners of a home? Is
it, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. You have
there's
to
like
have,
two.
Yeah.
Okay. Right now next door, but, I've got six.
But adding, yeah. Making, or having a requirement for two parking spaces if you have two bedrooms and an accessory dwelling unit, that doesn't seem necessary.
Maybe one per unit, possibly?
Yeah.
Or they can share if there's only one person in the house, you know, yeah. Whatever. Commissioner Preston.
Okay, I'm going to be kind of the other person here because I like to play devil's advocate anyway. But what you've done is essentially if you have an investor that's going out there and putting accessory buildings on there, and now you're creating a kind of increased density, a multifamily, on non-conforming lots in some of these smaller areas and so forth, there is a parking problem downtown, a huge parking problem downtown. It's going to get worse with this thing with this Curry Street thing going. It is nasty. Anyway, but even I look at some of the things that right now I'm seeing some accessory buildings over on Division Street. The one gal has they converted a garage into a studio, and thank goodness she has a Mini Cooper because she has it straddled right there on this small little apron. But just because somebody may not be using the parking spaces in their house, you know, let's say they have three bedrooms, the law allows that there would be up to six people in that house. Then you add your accessory building. If it has one bedroom or one room, that's another two people. So now you have eight people on that lot, and that creates a whole other different thing. So, I mean, that's just one of the things that I run into with rentals and people calling in the middle of the night because somebody's in somebody's parking space.
That's why when we originally looked at some of these, like down in Southeast Carson, where it's 5 acres or whatever, the parking's not a problem. They got plenty of places to put their cars. But when you start, and that was my concern at the last meeting, are we changing our neighborhoods by allowing these accessory dwellings? I don't want four of them or five of them on my, I would rather not have them on my street, preferably where there's a whole lot extra people living on that street. But again, once we let the cat out of the bag, so do we maybe look at it that this only goes forward for half acre or more bigger and just don't, whatever. That's another thing you could toss around.
Question. Thank you. So to address the parking issue, I think what Commissioner Stowell proposed was to have the parking be included, so to be included in 1.4.9A. So does that mean that would be that the parking situation of the residents would be, I guess, contemplated during the special use permit process? So there would be a check on that? Okay. So it's not just going to be like parking for everybody everywhere on every street.
Well,
we have a check.
My understanding would be that if you meet the minimum requirement in the ordinance, that's fine. You don't have to even go to them. But if you want to reduce it, if you want to change what that minimum is, then you have to come for a special use permit.
Well, unless it's, you know, a single family 6,000 or 12,000, they're getting a special use permit anyway.
They will anyway.
So under
why
that. That's the current proposal. That's the way it is now. That's the current proposal. So we, if you want to change that, you're going to see anyone, any accessory dwelling unit in single family 6,000 or 12,000 will be here, whether or not they're asking for any exceptions. So to your process, if they have two bedrooms and only one, and want to ask for one spot, we would have to make that amendment to that part so that they could, it would be part of the special use permit and not a variance as she suggested. I think I heard Commissioner S. Swine suggest that the standard should be one so that that's not even one per unit rather than one per bedroom, which would be a little different.
And as as I say, by bringing this 12,000 or less here, at least because theoretically they could just, without coming here, they could put a 700 square foot attached or unattached thing without talking to anybody. Just get a building permit and go do it. They didn't, wouldn't have to come here or whatever. On the smaller lots,
yes.
If we don't have that coming to special use permit, okay, we'll go the other side of that. A 1 acre, 2 acre can go out and just get a building permit and put a 1,000 square foot building, accessory unit, whatever, on their property without a special use permit.
That's correct.
But if we don't have the special use permit, could the 12,000, 6,000 and under do the same thing with a 700 square foot building without coming here? That's the change, you know, the difference.
That's not what's, that's not the current code. That's not what's proposed, but that would be the up to you to provide a recommendation.
But by leaving it in, they will have to come here.
Yes.
Which is smaller lots is where I worry about what's going to go on there and how it's going to be done, and I think it should come here.
Here's a thought, to sort of bridge these two issues maybe. Just like in Washoe County, if the accessory dwelling unit is being created as attached to that structure, they don't require you to come forward for a conditional use permit. Now, I don't know, I have to look back at the chart there. I don't know if it means that you're creating it within the existing footprint of that house, or if it also means that you could expand onto the footprint, but still it's an attached structure. But in Washoe County, they do not require you to get that conditional use permit. So that might be something to think about as a bridge between these two issues, to say, as long as you're maybe not even saying you're expanding the footprint, but saying you're creating that accessory dwelling unit, it's a separate dwelling unit within your existing primary residence, you don't have to get a special use permit. It's just a building permit.
But would you have it where if it was attached, say, to add 600 square feet off the back of the house, if it's attached, they wouldn't need it either. They still would need a building permit and be built to code.
It's just a variation on the theme. It depends how far everybody would be comfortable. But that might be a way to say, you know, really, if it's within the existing primary dwelling or it's a very small expansion, whether it's 600 feet, why would you need to come forward for a special use permit?
Because basically you could attach a 20 by 30 foot or 20 by 35 foot off the back. It's not a very big room. Because that's 700 feet. It doesn't take much to it. For that. Discussion on that.
Does that eliminate the garage conversion?
Well, it basically allows the garage conversion.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to do that.
Why not?
Above the garage.
Yeah, why not?
Height restrictions.
Use your microphone. I'm sorry. I guess I'd like to see it.
Come for a special use permit. It's not a smaller lot.
Yeah.
Well, no. What Candace was saying is that if it's an attached, if you're attaching it, then you don't need to come for a special use permit.
I'm going to go with the consensus of the group. So.
I mean,
we just need to get towards a consensus.
The whole garage conversion thing. You know, people could convert their garages now. You know, and they might not rent them out. They might just use them for a rec room or something. But, you know, they're eliminating the garage. And what difference does it make whether there's somebody, a non-family member using that or a family member using that?
Well, I would be okay with one parking place. I think that makes sense. Just to say one parking. If you're going to have an auxiliary dwelling unit, you need to have another parking place.
Yeah. It's like in my front of my house, I park both my cars in the driveway. When I had another car, I used to put it right next to it because there's room right next to that before the property line. So that's doable. But I think, as I said, I was getting all twisted over this 700 square foot. It's not a very big addition. So if it's part of the main house, do we have a problem with it? It'd be in the footprint or added onto the footprint. It's going to have to meet sight lines and everything else. Does that have to come for a permit? Because it's going to have to come for a building code and work with planning and whatever.
So if our intent here with this particular item is to go through this document and approve the changes that are highlighted and crossed out, and then any additions to the descriptions or definitions that are provided in this document. That is what we're supposed to be doing with this particular item, right? Okay, so where are we? Because I don't know that we've, like, gone through item by item and said, okay, on accessory dwelling has the same meaning as guest building. Is that okay?
That's what I've been trying to get the consensus of the board. The first thing is, can they rent it? Is allowed, can those people with those punk buildings rent them? That's the number one question. That's the biggest change in this. It's not, you can have anyone living there as a guest. I mean, the ultimate nice person would be that had one of these, they really want to help someone, let them live there for free. That ain't going
to
happen.
I think what we're trying to say is that if you want to have an accessory dwelling unit, it's got to have a kitchen. If you want to rent it, it's got to have a kitchen. I think that's kind of what we're saying.
So yeah, it's the definition of guest building that we are looking at. It says guest building means a dwelling unit, and the only changes that they've made to the description or the definition of guest building was they crossed out "and which is used exclusively for housing the family members of the primary residence and their non-paying guests," and included "attached or the manufactured not considered blah blah blah." So is that descriptor for guest building okay with the accessory dwelling has the same meaning as
that's what we've been talking about.
I think we've moved past that. So my understanding is it sounds like we plan on going back and clarifying that one way or another, looking at the definitions, how we do it and distinguish that. So then what I asked was to get some guidance on these parking types of discussion and minimum lot size to be able to incorporate those.
So we have to move the parking.
So I think we expect now not to have a recommendation go to the board today, but to go away and work.
I think the feeling is we want the parking thing moved back under 14.1. Is that, Candace, how Commissioner Stowell? And it would be one parking place per unit? I'm just trying to...
1.4.7 says that one off-street parking space for a guest building or multiple bedrooms.
Mike?
1.4.7 talks about required parking. And then it says that one off-street parking space or for guest buildings with multiple bedrooms, one parking space per bedroom.
We want to get rid of one parking space
per bedroom. Just one parking space.
Okay. Are we following that?
I think there was also a maybe proposal to, in 1.4.9 modifications,
move
to move a
to
parking
one.
To, yeah, to the special use permit as opposed to the variance.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to ask a question for clarification, just so I'm understanding I'm tracking this correctly. So a couple of minutes ago, there was a little bit of discussion on the record about, you know, are we going to allow a garage conversion or not? I think I heard from one commissioner, sure, that's a good thing, and I think I heard from another commissioner, maybe not, and then I think I heard from another commissioner yet that, well, maybe an above garage conversion would be fine. The way that dovetails into parking spaces, it's I'm trying to sort that out in my mind from a legal drafting perspective, because, okay, let's say if you're requiring one additional space for an ADU, but then you're allowing a garage conversion to be converted in ADU, but then by virtue of doing that, you're removing an existing one or two spaces. How does that work? So I just want to make sure that I have this clear in my mind. The other thing I want to point out, too, is I think it's good for us to have this starting document that, you know, that Lee's prepared. It's great as you know, it's sort of a guidepost for us. We can go through it. What I don't want us to get locked down into is this is what the structure is going to look like. This is a new concept that we're going to be establishing via legislation. there's a very good chance that when myself or another DDA gets their hands on it, it's going to look completely different from what you see today. So I would just say, I mean, if you feel as though you're being constricted by what's already in this as a model, think of it as just a model and a guidepost and nothing more.
Carson City does not require garage parking, so that's why you see garage conversions, because there's two, we require two off-sites, two on-site parking spaces per resident, so if there's a driveway, it fits two cars, that meets it.
I think if we could go ahead and separate attached, because if we're going to do a remodel on our houses and add an extra bedroom, or if we're going to go ahead and convert our garage, that's a remodeling permit, and I don't think it needs to, and that's a building permit type of a thing.
You still haven't got one right, but it's not a changing of
it. It's not a changing of, I mean, it's a remodeling permit that you get through the building department, typically, not through planning. What we're looking at is, if we separate that from there, and then they can figure out height restrictions, they can figure out setbacks, they can figure out if there's additional parking on something that's already attached. Don't care if it has a separate door, don't care if it has a separate porch, whatever. That would be building department. But if we limit this accessory building to what it is, it's an additional building.
Right.
So, I mean, if we can get past the remodeling things to add additional livable space that possibly be rented in, you know,
right. That
I think that would help.
I have Commissioner.
Although I think you still whether it's attached, whether it's a separate building, I think the point is to create functioning accessory dwelling units. And it goes further to say, you know, it'd be nice to promote this, to have more people doing it, and also further yet to have knowledge about where those ADUs are located. Because if this starts, I mean, obviously, whether it's Craigslist or whether it's apartments.com, that those bona fide ADUs should be made available to everybody that's living or wanting to live in Carson City. So I'm just afraid that if we just say, well, yes, a garage, you could just create a, you know, upstairs unit there, but to have standards for what that ADU needs to have so that it can be called a real ADU versus just a cot being stuck upstairs. So
you look at the information they gave us, they said monitoring some ADU programs have an annual affidavit requirement or other means of monitoring. I mean, that was just in the examples, but I highlighted that because it is something that is there.
Well, so, and it gets into the whole,
it comes to a code or whatever thing.
It gets into the big picture issue of whether you want the market to work or whether you want to start tying this into housing and community development programs. It's not to say that could be a component to come in much later down the road, that the city might want to use CDBG funds to help people create ADUs. But if they're going to use federal or state housing community development funds, then you're darn right you're going to have some kind of deed restrictions on that unit. You have to as part of the requirement to get those funds. But the point is, if you're letting the market work to create these ADUs, many of those ADUs are going to be rented at a reasonable, if not below market rate. And again, it's something that's, you know, obviously taking off in a lot of communities, and it would be a great asset for Carson City.
From both ends of the commission, we're getting, if attached, it isn't needed, but if it's attached in an ADU, it needs to have a kitchen. So, anyway, Commissioner.
Sorry, I have not worked on this, but I've worked with ADUs in other communities. So I'm hearing something. It brings back some nightmares, so I need to speak to it. Using different approval processes for something that's attached versus detached can become problematic from an implementation standpoint. What you end up with is, if you have an easy process, if it's attached, and a different process if it's detached, folks start doing things like a covered walkway and arguing it's attached. And you say, well, no, it's really its own building. You just have a covered. No, that's attached. And it just gets you a gray area. So I just want to, as the person who will be implementing this, want to caution you against that, because it does get difficult.
And along that thread, the easiest way is for us to be able to tell them what they need to do based on the building permit plans, not for us to have to regulate their behavior later. So if they give us plans with a kitchen, then we know what it is. If they give us plans with a kitchen, not without a kitchen, we know, or whatever. So we want them to be clear so that the plans they show us is what they are. We don't want to have to go back. I get you're talking about some of those things like owner-occupied and that, and that would have to be monitoring. But just generally speaking, with all zoning regulations, we don't want to have to go monitor the behavior of people using these spaces.
Do we still want to go line by line, or just let them rent them? I don't know. I'm looking for help.
I have a question came up last time about water usage, and then I came to Commissioner Preston asked me again. So I got some late information from engineering based on kind of the study they're doing now and I've looked at. So an average 1 acre property in Carson City uses 160 gallons per day in the winter. So that's what you use in the house, 160 in the winter, 700 in the summer. Which means you're in the summer. And the peak usage is really what the summer use is really the critical path. That's the supply that you have to plan to, not the lower end. So remember that 160, 700, that's about, the domestic house usage is about 22% of the total usage with landscaping in the summer. And interestingly, then we looked at the medium density residential, and it's almost identical. It's slightly less overall, but even with the irrigation in the summer, it's 680 gallons per day. So it's only 20 gallons per day less on a medium density, which is those 6,000, 12,000 square foot. And thinking about it, I mean, people with 1 acre, although it varies widely how much of it you landscape. There's a lot of places where they just landscape around the house. So that's it. And also the domestic usage in the house is very close. So people are taking as many showers in single family 6,000 as they are in six single family 1 acre. I can only assume. how does that, so when you have accessory dwellings, what happens then? Well, so there'll be a slight uptick in the thought is we have very few cases, and so they wouldn't be a sample anyway, but the thought is it'd be very negligible, because if in one situation, if you're adding a detached building, that's area you're not landscaping, and actually the landscaping is what has the highest percentage of water usage at the peak time. So that would be, so in any additional usage you'd have based on the additional occupants would be somewhat offset by that. I think there would be overall, there would have to be some additional water usage in the long run, but I think it would be minimal. And like I said, at worst on the average lot, adding a whole nother dwelling unit, it would be adding an additional 22% to what the overall average water usages on that lot. So that was just some information I thought was a little bit interesting I wanted to share. And
we currently don't have a limitation on water use, right?
No limitation on water use. You pay for the use.
You pay for the use. So it doesn't make
it matter, but it does matter in the sense of the long range planning to make sure we have enough water for all the available land we have.
Right, as long as it's taken into consideration, but to limit, to say, well, we can't have ADUs because, you know, they're gonna put a drain on our water supply. When we come nowhere close to meeting our building permit applications, and you know, under the what do they call it? We just did it a couple months ago. The growth management ordinance. You know, maybe we consider, you know, ADUs as dwelling units for the growth management ordinance to compensate or to deal with that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Borden.
There's not really very much language in here dealing with an attached unit. This is all primarily
detached. So if we left it that way.
Well, no, because even the size limit. So if you come in with the accessory dwelling that's within, you either remodel within the dwelling unit or add on, there's a defined area that we would measure that.
700,000.
Yeah, that we would look at the square footage. So it would still be limited in size, the setbacks. The setbacks for the accessory dwelling unit, even if attached, could not be second story and too close to the neighbor.
Well,
and
I understand that, but it does, in the definition, it says it's ancillary. It's detached.
It's subordinate to, not necessarily detached.
I think that still the number one hang-up on everything I hear is kitchen or no kitchen. I mean, do you agree they should be able to rent out their guest buildings? Can we get that far down the road?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got that part done. Okay, we've been doing this now an hour plus here, plus the last meeting. So the biggest hang-up, I don't care if the property owner's on site. There's a lot of reasons not to, but I appreciate the input on that. As far as the parking space, I think we've agreed it should be one parking space per whatever it is, a guest building, ADA, whatever it is. So I think the biggest hang-up still is Commissioner Stowell, I'm hearing from Commissioner Borders mostly as well, and maybe some others, the kitchen aspect. Mm-hmm.
And if I may, wouldn't that simply be, you know, with the building code, what's the minimum required for a dwelling? Because you get into that same argument about efficiency apartments, you know, because the building code normally has been like, you know, minimum 200 feet, and I think in some areas they've actually been allowing smaller units than 200 square feet. But whatever the building requires for a dwelling, and leave it at that, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Would that be all right?
So whatever it requires for a kitchen facility in a dwelling, the minimum kitchen facility in a dwelling, if it's going to qualify as a guest living quarters or guest whatever. Okay. Well, the guest building is referring back and forth. Does that work? Hope and Lee, did you pick, as far as what she's saying, whatever it requires for a dwelling unit, the minimum kitchen thing, it could be a microwave and a hot plate, okay? Any other items we need to consider on this?
No. Okay, we've got the kitchens down, and are they going to have restrooms, too?
Quickly to the ordinance again. So we're going, it can be used by other people. That's taken care of. We did 14.6, the parking. And the other underlying stuff, I'm not seeing any major problems with.
All right. Adding into 1.4.9, or that area of discussion, given that it might change, but having lot size be a possibility for revision as well as parking.
And we would allow, if it was under 6,000 square feet, they could still request possibly put something in?
Right, that's a lot size.
That'll continue below the 12 and 6. It would be lot size. Okay. Anything under 12, basically.
Anything under 6.
Mm-hmm. Well, 12 and 6 are all at 700 square feet.
But
if
you have a lot size smaller.
6 or smaller, okay. Okay. So does that take care of the underlying stuff?
So Chair, does that mean we're going to... Does it need, if as long as we know whether this is going to be a separate accessory dwelling unit or it's just going to be fleshed out more in terms of still keeping the guest building, if we can I'm just not sure whether that's, if we resolve that, then does it still need to come back?
Well, if we, since they go to each other, and if we're willing to take a kitchen in any dwelling unit, but then if the art studio, that's not actually an accessory dwelling unit, and it's not really a guest building, it's a remodel or whatever. If they're putting just an art thing out in the garage, right, they don't have to have a bathroom in the garage. Because what falls under guest buildings? Does it still fall where if somebody's using part of their house instead of, it's an office instead of, I mean, you can use a bedroom for an office, it doesn't change the use of the house.
Was your art studio, since I wasn't here, was the art studio a separate building or was it attached? I have no idea.
It's not a guest building.
Yeah, I think the art studio was here because it exceeded, as an accessory structure, it exceeded 75% of the primary structure. Or the cumulatively with. It's cumulative.
Mr. President, most of these we've seen were because they wanted to put in a 1,800, 2,000 square foot for mom and dad or whatever house behind their house, usually out on East Carson where they've got 4 or 5 acres. So. Yes.
Just for the record, I wanted to put it in that most of the CCNRs in Carson City do not allow these.
Let's hope that the homeowners in those communities can amend their bylaws, because I know that's going to come up a lot, and that's coming up in communities everywhere, amend those bylaws so homeowners, property owners can start putting ADUs in there. But again, the city doesn't enforce the CCNR, so good luck on that one.
But again, Commissioner Stowell, you said already at Shurer's Ranch. Is there anyone else you know that's doing that as well in our area, where they've actually got part of their buildings?
That's one of their models, is the next gen.
But I'm saying this is the first one you've seen of those locally?
I've seen the schematics of it.
Right.
I don't know if they've actually built some of those yet.
I think that's really great and interesting, mm-hmm, that they're at, mm-hmm, least looking ahead on that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are examples at Genoa Lakes, and there's also examples out in Dayton that have them.
Conference today, we picked up from some of those builders, they were looking kind of for possibilities of things like this. So do we need a motion or just basically, no, you'll bring back
all that for no motion?
I'm willing to make one.
You can certainly feel free to make a motion, Mr. Chairman, or to accept one, but not one is not necessary.
Okay. So this will come back anyway, regardless.
What a workshop is.
This was a nice workshop.
I just want to say thank you to Lee, the staff. It's great to see this moving forward. It may take a little longer than expected, but thank you. It's greatly appreciated.
Mr. Stowell, I want to thank you too for last week, and Commissioner Borders, when we were discussing this, it didn't look like it was going to go much of anywhere, and we continued it so Commissioner Monroe and Commissioner Eswine could be here and give input and have our full board's input, and it was helpful. Thank you. Are we done with that? Public comment.
No, we still have.
Well, I'd just see if there was any public comment on this issue. There isn't. Seeing none. Okay. So we are going to go with F2 for possible action to elect a Planning Commission chair and vice chair for a term beginning as the Planning Commission meeting of August of 2018. With the recent changes in the way the Board of Supervisors is selecting their commissioners, we had made this, this will be to carry out the rest of the term for 2018. There will be selections made, I believe, in December or whatever. There will be another election in January because we're going back to the old way, because when I came on, this is how they did it, was January, then they moved it. So anyway, this will be basically for a term of 6 months, and then there'll be another election.
Could I, may I suggest, if it's appropriate, that we would continue with the existing chair and vice chair?
I have a question first. The bylaws require give the chair a term limit of 2 terms.
This would be the start of my second term.
The 6 month one?
Well, so, no, I don't know. That would be another election, and whether I could continue or not would be up for discussion.
No, no. I mean, if you are continued, does that mean that you cannot then serve as president because you've done it twice in a row?
Well, we'd have to look. I think if it's like the, if you're part of, do only part of a term, you could do another if it's less than a year, possibly. But that's irrelevant at this point.
I think so.
Whoever would be vice chair at that point, if it can't be done, would take over his chair in January.
That's what I'm saying.
From what I read in the bylaws, I don't know if it vice chair, it addresses term, that if I was appointed in January of 11, so I was appointed and then put back on in July of the next year, and I could do another term because of the fact it's less than 2 years of a 4-year term. So I'm wondering if
that's not my question.
Your question is, if you do less than 6 months of a year term, can you do another six? I don't know.
No, my question is, as the chair and vice chair are also term limited, is that not correct?
Normally it's 2 terms or 2 years.
That's what I'm saying. So if you are elected to a second term for 6 months,
yeah, I could be done.
And then we come back in January, you're not eligible to be.
And the vice chair would probably move on to chair.
Well, I think that's terrible.
I'd like to make a motion to nominate Mr. Sattler as the to continue as chair and Commissioner Monroy as the vice chair.
I'll second.
Thank you. And we'll find out, Commissioner, what the term. I'm guessing that's how it works, but. I'm good with just 6 months.
I know you are.
Anyway, now we go back to F1. For possible action, to make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding amendment to the Planning Commission bylaws to change the bulk of election Planning Commission officers, i.e. chair and vice chair, from July to January to coincide with the start of the commission terms. Do we need a presentation on that, or
just real quick, Mr. Chair? The on the bylaws are attached to the staff report. On page one, it's not a change. I've just highlighted the change that the Board of Supervisors has made in paragraph A1, that the terms your terms expire on January 1 of each year. That used to say June of each year, so they now expire in January. So the change. Now that we're recommending, or at least to be consistent with how the bylaws were previously, is to change your officer terms commensurate with the start of the new commissioner's term. So you'll, rather than doing elections this month, which is when you used to have new commissioners come in, you will do them in January when the new commissioners come in. So that's the proposed change.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I'd like to move to recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of an amendment to the Planning Commission bylaws to change the month of election from Planning Commission officers from July to January to coincide with the start of the commissioner's terms.
On the comment on that, now that it's done, in essence, too, with their moving back to January from July, commissioners coming up are losing 6 months of their term as well. Because you and you two will be up in January where you came on in July. So hopefully they'll realize that as well. So anyway, where's my agenda?
Thank you. Just to cover a couple of things real quick. In July, the Board of Supervisors approved the Growth Management Ordinance, Growth Management Resolution as recommended by the Planning Commission when you reviewed it in May. Something that didn't come before the Planning Commission this time, but from the past, a tentative subdivision map for the for a Schultz investment. So this is same general family, different property. Up Clear Creek Road and Highway 50, there's a subdivision that was approved 4 years ago for six units, 6 5-acre parcels, and by development agreement that's been extended another 4 years. For next month at the Planning Commission meeting, it's on August 29th, we have a special use permit for a cell tower at 2750 Highway 50 East, special use permit for convert the old at 911 East 2nd Street, which is the old Greater Nevada Credit Union branch there, to a church. Special use permit for 2811 South Carson Street for a casino, which is going to be a transfer of a gaming license. That is, if you recognize that address, probably not. That's the former Grandma Hattie's building. And a master plan amendment, zoning map amendment for Old Hot Springs Road for an RV park. And it's actually a property that was relatively recently changed from commercial to industrial for a project at that time. Now they're going back, but that's okay. And
didn't we already do that? An RV park on Hot Springs?
And this is a smaller, different property than that RV park. This is property just to the east of the Hot Springs.
Oh, it's not the rear.
Not to the north, it's just to the east. Yeah. Well, the east. Yeah. And we have an application submitted for Lampa East. We're not sure it's complete to go forward and at your meeting, so still under review.
Lampa's been coming for months.
Yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to report that we did have, I know four members attend the Housing Committee. What was it called? The Housing Summit,
which was
really, they invited a lot of realtors were invited and were there, and also the rental property industry. And it was just an effort working with our Health and Human Services Department. One of the things is just to try to get some of the owners to help them provide housing at the income level needed. It's part of the overall housing committee that's meeting to try to find and make recommendations on different ways to address affordable workforce housing, one of which is accessory dwelling units. And they invited anybody who wants to attend those housing workshops to attend them, so in the future I'll send out that invitation to all of you, and I think she had something that had all the meeting dates, so I'll send that out to everyone. Anybody else have any?
Is that something, Lee, you think I should probably attend if I'm chair, just to show our presence there at the meetings?
Yeah, I think we have. I'll let you know if there's others that might want to attend, but it'd be good to have some representation on it. Yeah, I think they appreciated you showing up. They appreciate having planning commissioners there that are interested in there. So yes, I mean, I think that's a good idea. It doesn't, if somebody else wants to take the lead on that, that's fine. But it'd be good to have somebody there, yes.
Is that part of the CHIP, the Community Health Improvement Planning Group? I know there was an item that was pointed out as a focus, and that was workforce development, but as a kind of a underlying issue to that, workforce housing was being considered as an area of focus. So I didn't know whether that was part of that whole community health improvement plan that has been in the works with Carson City Health and Human Services?
I think largely it was started with, they mentioned with the mental health and whatever needing to help assisted housing, and it's grown then to just workforce and everything else. And they meet at the sheriff's office.
Yes.
Had the first Wednesday in August from like 9:30 to 11, 8 to 9:30, something like that. But it was very interesting and enlightening. It was neat to see the early part was more just a presentation, but then when they opened up the questions for Lee and others and the people there, it was really interesting to, you know, hear some of the input from people talking about builders saying, I gladly, you know, put some more things on my property if I can rent them, but I need to have the freedom in a number of years be able to sell it if I don't want to, you know, whatever kind of thing. I got one thing Commissioner Estrine and I were kind of chatting about a little today, and just want to toss out there is the possibility maybe of the Planning Commission having a workshop to where we could get together and share. We have new members that come with a lot of information and stuff for us as well that kind of toss ideas around, some thoughts and plans where we may want to look at, say, parking or other things, you know, kind of things that we might want to look into, and start out just with a meeting with us, and then possibly Commissioner Borders mentioned when he was on the Planning Commission, they met like monthly. It would allow people to come and, you know, ask whatever. Instead of having to go through the full process, they could kind of come and get a fee. Can you explain mm-hmm. that a little?
Well, it was an open workshop where they could, you could come if you had a project that you were working on, you could come and make a short presentation and get some feedback. You know, before Hope beat you to death or the building department, you know, you could at least have a conversation, and if six people on the commission said that ain't going to work, at least you don't have to spend any more money doing it.
Of course, they could go right to the planning department and ask that question without a fee, correct?
Supposedly, if they have time.
But isn't that, yeah, currently they would bring it to them anyway. But anyway, I don't know what the feeling is on that.
Would those still be subject to open meeting law?
Those would be, but okay. Just our workshop.
So the workshop would not be subject to open meeting law?
So.
Okay.
I think it would be for all hearings.
Yes. Yes.
It would be subject to open meeting, but it wouldn't be subject to
no public
noticing, you know, the discussion.
Yeah, we don't take any action.
Okay.
There's not necessary.
But I think they're still noticing.
I think it really kind of depends. I would need some more information on that. I mean, if there's going to be a quorum, and you guys are going to be discussing and deliberating on matters within the purview of this commission, then my suspicion is that that is going to be subject to the open meeting law.
Has anything like this been? I imagine we were saying with the master plan, they must have had some meetings with the commissioners. Did they just do it in smaller groups, or I'm looking more at this as an opportunity to share thoughts and ideas of the commissioners. We have some with planning backgrounds, some with real estate background, whatever, just to share that info, kind of like we did with getting this ADA stuff forward. So maybe be the horse instead of the cart.
I'm happy to look further into that, but you know, off the top of my head, I can't think of any exceptions to the general rule that if you have a quorum and you're going to be meeting on and discussing and deliberating on matters that or within the jurisdiction of this commission, even if you're not working towards, you know, an action, a quote-unquote action item, that is going to be subject to the open meeting law.
So I mean, I'm happy. Supervisors get away with their retreats when they take off for a weekend.
They notice it.
They do.
Yeah.
We could attend those retreats if we wanted to.
They sure notice it as a public meeting, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I would see us as posting it as a workshop with a general agenda and where people could come and listen or walk or they could.
Speaking of board workshops and strategic planning, I think I've heard they're thinking about possibly, I forget the timing of it, September, November, but anyway, sometime this fall, doing that, looking at the strategic plan. I think it's later in the year, but this type of discussion might tie into that, so we'll look into how that might help, either you making recommendations as part of that, or, and then maybe subsequently after that. The other way is make you have it, give you something to the Planning Commission that describes the strategic goals of the Board of Supervisors.
No, we did it with open space. When we did the land exchange, there actually was an open space, and they sat down with all the board members, were able to go in and do a workshop and make it, you know, kind of let us say, okay, great, there's certain things with this that we have to do with the BLM transfer, some things we don't, you know, kind of open some different things up. But it gave us a better chance to know each other and go through the workshop, so.
I think it'd be a wonderful idea to have a workshop, you know, and maybe there are several things that certain commissioners would like to have on the agenda to talk about, and to let the public know what the conversation will be about at the workshop in case people want to come and talk about certain things. I think a workshop would be also helpful in terms of just talking about the master plan and where we are with it today. It would be very helpful.
Have it like master plan and parking and whatever else, that, you know, downtown park, whatever, you know, things that are issues to us, kind of get them in our heads to bring forward to the agenda, and then we'll just discuss them and, you know, kind of throw them around. Public comment. Seeing none, I'll take a motion for adjournment, I guess. Huh?
I'll move we adjourn.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you all.
I didn't figure it out until just you only got so many months to go at this time.
No, I don't mind doing another if that's what I'm doing.